We're privileged to have here Judge Diane Sykes as the moderator of our next panel on economic uncertainty and the role of the courts. She was appointed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals by President George W. Bush and began service on July 4th, 2004. A very wonderful date to begin. She previously served as a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She had practiced in Milwaukee at the firm of White and Hirschbeck and had clerked for Judge Terrence T. Evans. She received her JD from Marquette University, but before doing so, she practiced the dark art of journalism at the Milwaukee Journal, as some others of us have done before coming to law school. She has the great distinction of attending the second ever National Student Symposium of the Federalist Society, and even a greater distinction in being the mother of two sons. Please welcome Judge Sykes.
Thank you, Joseph, for that very nice introduction, and I'm very happy to be here with you for this 30th anniversary of the Federalist Society Student Symposium. This last session of the conference today will take up the topic of the role of the courts in times of economic uncertainty. This panel will approach the subject in a little different way from last night's debate and panel. You'll recall that from time to time during the discussion last night, the topic of the role of the courts was taken up, but more in the sense of the appropriate interpretive philosophy that courts should bring to bear in their decision method on constitutional cases. This panel instead will explore the role of the judiciary from somewhat a more structural standpoint. That is, what kind of legal system and judicial model best protects economic rights and perpetuates a sound economic system. The discussion will touch on some history, some theory, some legal doctrine, and some empirical evidence, starting with the Treaty of Paris and perhaps a little bit before that, moving through the founding period and up to and including the challenges of our present economic moment. We are looking for some lessons about the economic consequences of alternative legal and judicial models and practices. Now, that's an awful lot to cover in what's left of the afternoon, but we have a very distinguished panel here this afternoon, and the panel is certainly up to the task. First up will be Professor Paul Stephen, who teaches here at Virginia Law School and is an expert in international business, taxation, and constitutional law. Among many other notable professional activities, he has been an advisor to the State Department and worked extensively on economic and law reform issues in the former Soviet states. He clerked for Judge Campbell at the First Circuit and Judge Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. He has bachelor's and master's degrees from Yale University and earned his JD here at the University of Virginia. Paul Mahoney is dean of the law school here at Virginia, and he teaches securities regulation, corporate law, and contracts. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and like Professor Stephen, has also worked on law reform projects in Central Asia. He clerked for Judge Ralph Winter at the Second Circuit and Justice Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. He has degrees from MIT and Yale Law School. And finally, Professor Todd Zwicky teaches at George Mason University School of Law, and his areas of expertise are bankruptcy, consumer protection and finance, and law and economics. He has served as director of the Office of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission, and like our other panelists, has consulted on law and economic matters with governmental officials from all across the globe, including Iceland, Italy, Japan, and Guatemala. He was a law clerk for Judge Jerry Smith at the Fifth Circuit. Professor Zwicky has bachelor's and master's degrees in economics from Dartmouth College and Clemson University and earned his JD here at Virginia. So we have an all-Virginia panel in one form or fashion. Professor Stephen.
Thank you, Judge Sykes. It's a honor and a privilege to be part of this conference. I'm sorry I wasn't here the entire time, but I came in late on a plane from Denver last night, so I'm doing the best I can. My argument today is going to be that not about the importance of legal entitlements, and I'll use that phrase, but what I particularly have in mind is private law, property and contract. It's not an argument about the a priori importance of legal entitlements, but rather a separation of powers issue about which branch of government has the comparative advantage of responding to unforeseen circumstances that challenge those entitlements. We'll start, I hope, with common agreement that, A, stability and entitlements are good. Professor Mahoney, I think, Dean Mahoney, I should say, he's my boss, will give us some empirical evidence that bolsters that proposition, but I think that proposition is self-evident. In the DNA of the United States, let me just remind you briefly that our Constitution was created to solve an international law problem, the failure of the United States to honor the Treaty of Paris, and namely to respect property and contract rights that had been framed before the Revolution. And the price, if you will, of our independence from England was enduring respect of those entitlements. Second point is that property and contract recognizes that there are unforeseen circumstances. There are many doctrines that take this into account. So that stability is not the same thing as stasis. The issue is how do we take account of unforeseen circumstances, such as an economic crisis. And the third general point is that economic crises are unforeseen in their timing and severity, but not in their existence, that we can count on them occurring. I realize people in the real estate market didn't believe this for a while, but most people do understand that prices do go down on occasion. So the question is not, does an economic crisis amount to an unforeseen circumstances that require adjustment of entitlements? The issue is, does an economic crisis create the kind of broad excuse for judges to interfere in economic entitlements? And we should consider judges in competition with the other branches. There are some obvious ways in which we, in the United States, and as far as I know, in every developed market-based or social democratic legal system in the world, where we tolerate redistribution in response to changed circumstances. One is bankruptcy. Another is the widespread right of, widely recognized right of the state to expropriate property as long as there is a legitimate purpose and they pay for it. But both of these examples are examples based on both legislative and executive authorization where courts execute legislative commands rather than on their own deciding that people should be relieved from their debts, that property ought to be transferred to somebody else on their own. So what are the arguments for a judicial role in advance of the executive and legislative branch? I will describe two that I've encountered and then criticize both. The first was articulated by a very distinguished jurist, Chief Justice Ehud Barak of the Israeli Supreme Court, who a few years ago when we were on a panel together, it would be really demeaning to him to say we were on a panel together. He was on a panel that I happened to be on, where he was asked to talk on law in a time of crisis, and rather than talking about terrorism, he talked about hyperinflation and the role of Israeli courts in responding to hyperinflation. He made the argument that single-digit inflation is normal background noise. Double-digit inflation is something that is a concern, a challenge to the system, but that we can expect normal governmental processes to respond to those challenges. But when you get to triple-digit inflation, which Israel has known, we haven't in the last century or so, that the other branches of government are no longer capable of responding with sufficient alacrity to such a crisis, and the courts, by compulsion, by default of the other branches of government, have to step in. And he used this, of course, as an example. He was trying to make a general point with a single example. The critique that I would suggest of this argument is that there are constitutional systems, and Israel, I think, is one, where the judges have to get out ahead of the other branches because of certain structural commitments. The proportional representation plus the lack of an independently elected government which is a common model throughout much of the world. That's to say, you don't have a president who runs and forms a government. You have someone who puts together a coalition based on the distribution of parliamentary power, and the system is structured in such a way that there will always be diverse and disparate parties that will form a coalition. That this does create an inhibiting effect on a rapid government response to serious crises. Essentially, in order to respond to a crisis, a government has to surrender its right to govern because it will create a new election. And under these circumstances, you can understand, I think, why a default to the judiciary might be appropriate. But there are other systems, Westminster-type systems, including the U.S. variant, where that structural argument isn't true. And in general, the evidence, I don't think, is there that we need the courts to respond in advance of the executive and the legislature to economic crises. I think the most recent 2008 crisis is a pretty good example, where based on legislative authorization, the executive branch put together a package that many might find objectionable in the particular, but at least nothing seriously bad happened. Maybe bad precedents were set, maybe rather disturbing redistributions took place. I put that aside. The point is it wasn't disastrous. The other argument is articulated by yet another Virginian absent here, a beloved absent colleague, Saul Levmore, who was Paul and my colleague for many years before he lost his way and went off to Hyde Park. He developed an ingenious argument. Dean Levmore, like all three of the panelists, are interested in what we might call the Virginia School of Political Economy, the public choice theory developed by Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock here in our economics department at Virginia, and made the quite straightforward argument that capture is a serious problem. That one of the ways to respond to capture is to destabilize the entitlements that are created through capture. He was discussing specifically litigation like the reparations litigation, like the suits against tobacco, the suits against gun manufacturers, the idea that people could, through common law developments, common law tort concepts, obtain compensation for activity that was clearly legal at the time it took place, however objectionable it might be. His argument was in defense of such litigation, saying that without the threat of judicial instability, entitlements obtained through a public choice describe processes that allow capture by concentrated minorities will remain entrenched. And unentrenching these entitlements is a good thing. With respect and reverence for my smarter younger brother, Dean Levmore, I would say that there are at least two problems with his argument. One is it's hard to tell the difference between entitlements created by capture and entitlements created by the normal operations of the system. Secondly, I think, as brilliant as he has a naive conception of how civil litigation works. And I would argue that capture through litigation is another public choice problem, that just as legislatures can be captured, just as agencies can be captured, assuming something less than omniscience on the part of judges and assuming that there is value to having a particular kind of attorney, a particular kind of advocate, that there's no reason to believe that the quality of advocacy will always be on the side of the good of the public interest, and that without taking into account public choice distortions through litigation, the argument fails, in my judgment. So this is a negative argument rather than a positive argument. You have to start with the background assumption that stable entitlements are good, and then knock down arguments and supporting judicial destabilization of those entitlements, and this is my effort to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm grateful to all of you for being here on a Saturday afternoon. So this panel is supposed to address economic uncertainty and the role of courts. We know a lot more about the first than we do about the second. That is to say, we know about the effects of uncertainty, especially uncertainty about property rights on the economy. We know less about the extent to which institutional arrangements can guarantee security of property, and even less still about whether they can create secure property rights where they don't already exist. There are very strong theoretical reasons, as my colleague Paul Stephen told us, to believe that property rights are a first-order determinant of the health of the economy. Indeed, Adam Smith linked investment and growth to what he called the security of property. It also seems reasonably clear that the security of property rights is connected to the structure of government. When we compare societies around the world with despotic governments to those with limited governments, the latter usually have better property rights and are usually more prosperous. And that would be true if we compare, say, the Netherlands before and after independence from Spain in the 17th century, or if we compare Zimbabwe and Botswana today. Now, we can look at the question more systematically, and many scholars have set out to do just that. I'm going to draw on a large body of work to which many scholars have contributed, and I've posted a couple of citations to some review articles on the conference website for those of you who are interested. A simple starting point is to ask whether, as we look around the world today, the security of property rights is associated with the degree of economic prosperity. When we set out to do that, we quickly discover that we can't determine the security of property rights just by looking at the statute books. In general, non-communist countries have formal protections for property rights. But we probably share an intuition that even if the formal rules about property are the same in Luxembourg and Paraguay, nevertheless, property is more secure in Luxembourg. In addition, I'm going to have to use the term property rights pretty loosely because, as we all know, there are many, many things a government can do to interfere with property rights other than outright theft. It can regulate to the extent that property can't be used profitably. It can devalue the currency to the point where paper assets become worthless. It can allow politically favored entities to play by different rules than everyone else. So I will use the terms property rights and economic freedom broadly to refer to the absence of those forms of interference. Now, various organizations and scholars try to measure the de facto security of property rights. Companies like Political Risk Services create survey-based measures for the use of private sector clients who invest abroad. The Heritage Foundation calculates an index of economic freedom that incorporates some of these other forms of interference with property rights that I just discussed. Now, in general, those sorts of measures correlate quite highly with economic prosperity. Interestingly, those measures of economic rights tend to correlate more highly with prosperity than do measures of political freedoms. So compare, just to take one example, Morocco and Singapore. Both have a parliamentary government, but both are somewhat intolerant of dissent. They have identical scores on two of the most common measures of political freedom, Freedom House's index of political rights and its index of civil liberties. However, Singapore scores much more highly than Morocco on the Heritage Foundation's index of economic freedom. Singapore is a much wealthier country. Indeed, its per capita GDP is more than 10 times that of Morocco. But now we get to the hard part. Why does Singapore, which has a similar level of political freedom, have more secure property rights than Morocco? Indeed, why does it have more secure property rights by most measures than Italy, which has far more political freedom? And even more importantly, could Morocco get as wealthy as Singapore by altering its government structure in some way to limit its ability to interfere with property and other economic rights? One traditional answer, as we all know, goes back to Montesquieu, and it looks to institutions like federalism and an independent judiciary as checks on governmental power. The idea is that governments are always tempted to engage in short-run interference with property rights and other economic freedoms for temporary political advantage, even at the cost of long-term harm to the economy. And the more constrained the government is, the harder it will be for it to engage in those short-term strategies, and indeed the harder it will be for capture, as Professor Stephen has spoken about, to take place. And broadly speaking, that's the story we tell ourselves about the founders. They wisely set up a government with many checks and balances that limit the federal government's ability to interfere with property and contract rights. A piece of anecdotal evidence for that theory is the difference between England and France in the early 18th century. After the Glorious Revolution, England's monarchy was considerably more constrained than the monarchy of the Sun King and his Bourbon successors in France. Now, during that period, England developed robust financial markets, improved its commercial markets, and moved ahead economically of France, which fell behind. Well, there is, though, an alternative view of the history, and the alternative view is that we've got the causation backwards. Societies don't respect property rights and become rich because they have constrained government. They get constrained government and secure property rights because they are rich. Once people start to accumulate property and insist on a less intrusive and predatory government, they tend to be able to get their way. Now, a piece of anecdotal evidence for that theory is the Korean Peninsula. Before World War II, of course, Korea was under a single government, and the North and the South had, broadly speaking, a similar level of economic development. After the war, the country is partitioned into North and South Korea, and both are initially ruled by autocrats. But the North's autocrat decided to pursue socialism, while the South's autocrat chose to pursue a market economy. The South grew prosperous, and the North grew impoverished. Eventually, the citizens of South Korea would no longer accept autocratic rule and created a more limited form of democratic government. Now, clearly, those two stories have very different implications for how a country can go from low to high security of property and from poverty to wealth. The first suggests that you need to tie Leviathan down, and then you will get prosperity. The second suggests that you need to get lucky and have the right Leviathan, or at least persuade Leviathan to adopt pro-growth policies, and eventually you'll get limited government in the bargain. Well, so far I've provided anecdotes. Do we have any systematic evidence that can tell us which story is correct? Well, we have systematic evidence, but unfortunately it's not conclusive. Here's a piece of evidence in favor of the constraining government causes prosperity hypothesis. If we compare countries around the world, there are quite systematic differences between those that were colonized by England and those that were colonized by France, Spain, or other continental powers. In particular, former English colonies tend to have larger and more liquid financial markets, and their economies also grew faster in the post-colonial period from 1960 to the 1990s after controlling for the initial level of development. That's important evidence for two reasons. First, the English theory of government, which it transported to its colonies, was one of limited government and secure property rights. The French and Spanish theory, by contrast, was of a strong central state in which the government was not so constrained in pursuing collective ends. Second, and equally important, we don't have to worry about reverse causation. The fact that Australia is a wealthy country today did not cause England rather than Spain or France to colonize it. Wealth, in that theory or in those results, does not cause good institutions because it didn't cause colonization. So that's good evidence in favor of the proposition that institutional constraints cause wealth. But a piece of evidence in favor of the prosperity causes constraints on government hypothesis is that most poor countries in the middle of the past century had more or less despotic governments. In some, like South Korea, Taiwan, and Chile, the despot chose pro-growth policies, and the country became prosperous relative to its neighbors and later developed more constraints on governmental power. Well, here's what I take away from the analysis. I'll confess that I am drawn to the first of the two hypotheses, but here's what I take away from the evidence itself. There are two common packages consisting of institutions, policy choices, and economic outcomes. One package includes constrained government, generally pro-growth policies, secure property rights, and prosperity. The other includes unconstrained government, generally anti-growth policies, low protections for property rights, and poverty. Each package is common, and in each one, the institutions, the policy choices, and the economic outcomes are mutually reinforcing. Now, interestingly, once you start to mix and match pieces from each of the packages, you create some tensions. So take China, which has fairly unconstrained government, somewhat more pro-market policies, low but improving property rights, and increasing prosperity, starting, of course, from a very low level. This package is not mutually reinforcing, and China is likely to face ongoing political conflicts despite the best efforts of its rulers to hold on to unconstrained power. Similarly, our system of checks and balances, federalism, an independent judiciary, etc., does not prevent episodic interference with property rights in the United States, such as ignoring the normal rules of creditor priority in the Chrysler and General Motors bankruptcies, enacting a health care law that requires citizens to buy insurance, whether they want to or not, or playing favorites with certain industry sectors or individual companies. But the most recent outbreak of those interferences produced a quite powerful popular backlash that may operate as a more potent constraint than federalism, bicameralism, you name it. I'll close with a final observation. Because the literature on economic development is concerned primarily with how to get poor nations out of poverty, it has tended to see the demand for good policies and good institutions as always rising with the level of wealth. And history certainly suggests that a country with a middle class is more likely to demand good institutions than one without it. But the experience of Europe and America over the past, say, half century suggests that the relation between wealth and the desire for limited government may not be linear on all parts of the spectrum, that like many economic relationships, it may at some point become curvilinear. Once you reach a stage where the marginal voter owns a house, a car, and a flat-screen TV, the marginal voter may become less interested in growth and more interested in stability. And of course, the eternal justification for larger and more powerful government is stability. Perhaps then, paradoxically, limited government may be very popular until it produces an extremely high level of success for its society. Thanks.
Well, somehow it feels appropriate that I'll be the last speaker of scheduled speaker of all the panels, not just because my last name starts with ZYW. I also looked at the schedule and I said, Why didn't they just skip all the mileage, just have this at George Mason rather than trucking all of us down to here? And I thought, well, no, it would have made even more sense. If we're going to just have a bunch of Volokh conspirators, we should just had a cyber a virtual symposium with Randy and Adler and myself. But then I realized it was just an excuse for me to come back to UVA, to my alma mater, and I wore my tie and everything, so I could come back to the old homestead. And the question that's presented for this panel is, should judges protect private property rights and constitutional rights the same in times of crisis as they do every other time, in ordinary times? And what I take away from the most current experience is that not only is the answer yes, but the answer is that judges should protect private property more in times of crisis than in ordinary times, both as a matter of good economic policy as well as preventing precedents that give rise to a predatory state. So let me unpack that. First, in a nutshell, I think Paul Mahoney, really did a marvelous job giving an overview of the literature. But the basic idea is Hayekian, which is that the basic idea is that the world is in flux. It's a miracle that anything happens, really. People talk about sort of the miracle that milk shows up in your refrigerator on any given day or in the cafeteria. If you think of all the chain of coordination that needs to be done to get milk for farmers to even know to make dairy cows, right? And you think of all the coordination in that chain and all the signals and all the flux that's going on in trying to create an economy that works, Hayek's observation is given the level of discoordination, given the level of disequilibrium, the world's constantly in disequilibrium, what we really need to focus on is minimizing the amount of variables that people have to deal with. And obviously, one of the big variables that people have to deal with is the legal regime. And so one of the things you take away from Hayek is what's of crucial importance is in a world that is dominated by flux, if you want to have economic activity, you've got to have as much stability in things like the legal regime as possible. Just think about, for instance, what it takes to make a loan. And what we've seen is that credit markets were obviously, blown up and very slow to recover. And we can understand why credit markets have been so slow to recover. In order to make a loan, you've got to basically be able to do two things. Either you've got to be able to price the risk of the loan accurately, or you've got to reduce your risk exposure. What we saw over the past couple of years in response to or as a rationalization from the financial crisis is a huge amount of instability and chaos that makes it very difficult for people to price loans. And as a result, what we have seen is that lenders have responded by reducing their risk exposure, by lending less and lending to fewer people. So think about, for example, the Credit Card Act, one of the most horrible things that's come around in the past few years. And one of the things that the Credit Card Act does, it does a lot of things, but one of the things it does is it makes it more difficult to raise interest rates when somebody's risk profile changes. It does a lot of other things it does, but basically that's what it does. What's the implication of that? Well, first, if you can't raise somebody's interest rate when they become more risky, what do you predict that credit card issuers will do? They'll just raise everybody's interest rates ahead of time. And that's exactly what we've seen come out of the market. If you can't price risk accurately by raising interest rates, what do? You reduce risk exposure. You lend less and you lend to fewer people so that a lot of people have seen their credit lines slashed. And Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, last year in a shareholder letter said that 15% of J.P. Morgan Chase's customers who had previously received credit cards would not be able to get credit cards anymore. You have to reduce your risk exposure if you can't price your risk accurately. And so in that sense, it'd be a miracle if we did see life in credit markets. You pile on top of that, that healthcare reform, the possibility we had for a cap and trade for a while, a really extraordinary growth in the regulatory state. And what you're talking about is the whole tax showdown that came about at the end of December, everything that's in Dodd-Frank. You start adding all that up and you just think, what would it take to try to figure out how to make a loan, how to price the risk of a loan that's going to be repaid in a year or 5 or 10 years from now when you have no idea what the legal regime is going to be like? Third, when judges fail to enforce rights, it creates a target-rich environment for opportunistic politicians. And as the previous speakers have noted, basically the reason we have private property rights and constitutional rights is to constrain politicians. And when you fail to constrain politicians, they take advantage of that. GM and Chrysler being the obvious example, where the government intervened to plunder the secured creditors in Chrysler, basically stealing money from the secured creditors, who included, incidentally, the Indiana Teachers and Firemen's Pension Fund, basically destroyed the settled rules of bankruptcy just so they could transfer a windfall to the UAW. What this ends up doing is creating political risk, and now we've seen at least one paper that talks about the political risk that was created by Chrysler in General Motors. I wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal called Chrysler and the Rule of Law, where I said that we never had to really worry about political risk in the United States, and that this sounded more like Hugo Chavez than the United States. Until Chrysler. And I got a very outraged email from a lawyer in New York, and he said, that is unfair. When Hugo Chavez steals people's money, property, he compensates them. And so I have to make a mea culpa for that overstatement in my column. The next thing we see is that the discretion, once you unleash political discretion, it creates a ratchet effect. And so what you see is that once politicians relax, or once judges relax the rules and allow politicians to do their thing, it creates a ratchet effect. And I think Dodd-Frank is really a marvelous example of that, which is that basically what Dodd-Frank does is takes the arbitrariness and the discretion that characterized the bailouts and the response to financial crisis and institutionalizes it. It institutionalizes the idea of politicians picking winners and losers in the political market. Now, the historical example of this is the Great Depression. Which is that basically saw was the Great Depression became an excuse for judges to stop enforcing contract and property rights. And what we saw is basically reaping the harvest after that of basically the rise of the administrative and rent-seeking state in the 20th century. The response to the bailout and the failure to protect property rights during that is basically taking that one step further. A good example is the Durbin Amendment, which you may not be familiar with. But the Durbin Amendment places price controls on debit card interchange fees, which are the fees that that the merchant pays when you use your debit card. But it only places in a couple ways. First, only if you're a bank above $10 billion in assets. Why? I don't know, because we don't like those guys and we like smaller banks, seems to be the example. And that's apparently a good enough reason these days for creating that sort of thing. Why do they pass in the first place? Basically because merchants, and in particular apparently the CEO of Walgreens, called up Senator Durbin and said, you know, these interchange fees are killing us. Can you do something about it? And he said, well, how about if I reduce them by 80%? All right, now we've got a reduction of interchange fees of 80% is basically what's going to end up happening. But what the principle here is that it becomes common, it becomes conventional to pick and choose winners and losers in the political politicians to pick and choose winners and losers in the economic marketplace rather than leaving it up to those who do the best job providing goods and services to consumers. Related to that, discretion promotes rent seeking, which is that once you find out that the favor office is open in Washington, basically everybody sends their lobbyists down there. And what we've seen is an incredible explosion of lobbying as people try to funnel more money to themselves, try to get more loopholes to themselves, and keep others from getting it, whether it's green subsidies, whether it's Dodd-Frank, whether it's any of these sorts of things. Basically what happens is it just the entire economy becomes politicized, basically as a buying and selling of favors. Who wins in that? Big business, right? Big interests are the ones who win in that game. What we often forget is that the value of the rule of law is to protect the little guy. Big business, Goldman Sachs, General Motors, right? These guys can hire the lawyers. They can hire the lobbyists to create and exploit the loopholes that they want. It's the rest of us who end up not getting it. And I think what we've seen is, if you really want to understand Obamanomics, it's not socialism. It's basically a return to the economy of the 50s and the 60s, a symbiotic relationship of big business, big government, and big labor, basically imposing stasis on the American economy, stifling entrepreneurship and dynamism. That's what we're getting out of this, is a blanket of rent-seeking and regulatory activity that favors those large entrenched interests in a political sort of way that I think that they're banking on. Final thought is, when you intervene based on sympathy, crisis, that sort of thing, it is now clear that you do create moral hazard. The bank bailouts can be traced in a straight line back from the 2008 bank bailouts to the bailout of long-term capital management in the 90s to Continental Illinois in the 1980s. The idea of too big to fail goes way back, and once you know you're too big to fail, then you're playing with the house's money. And that's basically what we saw, was the inevitable unwinding of that process in the financial crisis. But it's not just banks that do it. We see it also when it comes to, like, foreclosure. So states that have anti-deficiency laws, which limit the bank to taking back your house and not being able to sue you for any amount you owe on your debt, empirical studies suggest that foreclosure rates are 2 to 3 times higher in states that have anti-deficiency laws. Why? Because they're basically a get-out-of-jail-free card for consumers. So if your house is underwater, you've got much stronger incentives to walk away in that situation. We've seen it also. If we create foreclosure amelioration and mitigation that makes it more expensive, more difficult, more lengthy to foreclose, what happens? More people default. More people go into foreclosure, and then they basically get to live in their house rent-free. People do respond to incentives over the long run. So I think that what we've unfortunately should have learned from all this is that in a time of crisis, we want to have stronger rules. We want to tie government's hands stronger, and we should have done that a long time ago. Instead, I fear that the lesson we're taking from it is the opposite, which is, in a time of crisis, we want to unleash government discretion and arbitrariness. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Before I jump in with a few questions here to further develop the arguments, I wonder if any of our panelists have a response to the other panel members. Otherwise, I can go ahead.
Can I say something very quickly? One of the problems with this panel, I thought, when we organized it, is that the three of us seem so much alike, probably because of our common roots in Charlottesville, that it will be hard to get an argument going. But let me try anyway. I I'm not sure Professor Zawicki will disagree with what I'm about to say or not, but I'll try and disagree. The argument that I will make is this, that instability in common law judging contract and property is a concern for the reasons I've articulated. Let me throw out something that was unstated in my main remarks, but is implicit, I hope, which is that instability in constitutional lawmaking by the courts is also a problem, that calling it a constitutional claim rather than a common law claim doesn't alter the instability that's created. Now, that doesn't mean that we surrender constitutional norms where they apply, but the idea of new constitutional lawmaking, and we can then get into a deep debate about what is new and what isn't, is to me just as problematic as new arguments in contract to property.
Professor Zawicki, any response?
I agree with that completely.
Okay.
So. Sorry, I'm sorry. Good
no
try
fight.
Getting an argument started.
Okay. Well, let me ask a couple of questions here before we throw it open to the audience here. Dean Mahoney, you talked about the empirical evidence and what it does and doesn't show with respect to the perpetuation of prosperity, and in particular the evidence from the experience of England and its colonies and continental European nations and their colonies. And you identified some of the differences between the two systems, primarily the limited government, strong private property protection and pro-growth economic policies in England and its colonies, and quite the opposite in the nations of continental Europe. And I wonder if one of the other differences as it relates to the legal system in particular is the fact that England and its colonies adopted a common law system as opposed to a civil law system. And I wonder if you could address the differences and the extent to which that accounts for the differences in prosperity.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and it's one that's been debated quite a lot within both the economics literature and the legal literature. And part of the problem is that no two people seem to mean the same thing when they distinguish a common law and a civil law system. So one thing that I've tried to hone in on is the role and status of the judiciary itself. As a rough approximation, in most of the civilian world, judges are closer to the regular bureaucracy. There tend to be far more of them. They have more of a typical career path that you would see in a bureaucracy. You get a really low-level judgeship out of law school, and then you get graded by someone in the justice ministry, and you get you move up the ladder depending on pleasing your superiors and so forth. Whereas, of course, in a common law system, once someone is appointed a judge at any level, that is a post with a sufficient degree of prestige, autonomy, and of course formal measures of independence, that it makes that judge relatively immune from political pressure. As a way to try to see whether that difference has any actual impact, one thing I did was to go back and look at the financial markets in England at the time that English judges gained formal independence, which was through the Act of Settlement in 1701. And prior to that time, we did see that the Stuart kings in particular sometimes fired judges that they didn't agree with, and at least as a formal matter, judges served at the king's pleasure. So beginning in 1701 as a statutory matter, judges serve during good behavior, and the king can neither dismiss them nor decrease their salaries. Well, one thing that I find very interesting, and fortunately from an empirical perspective, there were a number of steps during the legislative process that one can identify where people would have changed their views about how likely it was that judges were going to prevail in the legislative arena. And what we see is that at every one of those stages, you see increases in the value of traded financial assets in England. And my interpretation of that, and of course, you know, this is one episode in a lot of history, so you don't want to go overboard, but it seems to me that one plausible interpretation of that evidence is that as England was moving to an economy in which forms of paper wealth were going to be important, it was particularly important that it be hard to simply get rid of those forms of wealth or through the political process undercut their value. And traders viewed the formal protections that the judiciary gained, particularly because the judiciary was associated with protection for commercial and economic interests, as being an important thing. So I think there's some evidence there. Again, I don't want to overstate it, but it seems to me that at least the evidence is consistent with exactly the story you suggest.
Well, expanding on that, the distinctions between a civil law and a common law system are, in the civil law system, the judges are more closely aligned with the regulatory bureaucracy, and in a common law system are independent and shielded from those influences. And in my view, some of the traditional virtues of the common law system have been its emphasis on strong contract and property rights enforcement and its tendency to greater predictability and incrementalism in the development of tort law and other doctrines. our current reality, of course, is that our legal regime is pervasively statutory and regulatory, and both at the federal and state level, and that both the federal and state economic regulatory regimes increasingly have private causes of action as enforcement mechanisms for new regulatory rights that are created in these schemes, and that these tend to proliferate, as Professor Zwicky noted, during times of economic crisis. And when you combine that reality with the sort of entrepreneurial use of the class action device, you've got a tendency to thrust the courts into the role of more or less a super regulatory agency as opposed to independent arbiters or adjudicators of private civil wrongs. Discuss.
I agree with everything that Professor Mahoney said or Dean Mahoney said, but there's another thing that's always struck me about this literature that's very interesting on the common law versus civil law. One thing that's always struck me as very plausible, people pointed out, is that historically, at least, the focus of the common law was private ordering, which is to say that the common law was seen as a mechanism for resolving disputes between private individuals, so that the law was essentially reactive. And the goal was to basically create coordination and resolve private disputes between private citizens, whereas the civil law was fundamentally proactive, an assertion of sort of state or governmental authority to sort of create and resolve disputes before they even arose. And so that there was sort of an inherent engine of intervention in civil law that was lacking in the common law. Your comments prompt my response to this is because basically what we've done is over time is we've turned the common law into something much more like the civil law, where the common law becomes much more of an engine for social engineering and economic planning and social planning and that sort of thing. And I think the legal realist revolution contributed to that as well. But I do think what we're seeing is that the common law, I think that initial distinction seemed plausible to me, but I do think that in many ways the common law has been drifting more towards the civil law, which I think is unfortunate to my mind.
Judge Sykes, you said words that get me going like an old fire station horse and a fire alarm when you said private cause of action. My career really started when I was working for Justice Powell, and he was writing his dissent in Buchanan versus University of Chicago, which I think is sort of the origin of the private cause of action critique that's developed over the years. And let me just identify that as an instance where common law courts still have an important role in an age of statutes. I mean, Congress, it seems to me, has the capacity to do some dreadful things, and Dean Mahoney's discussion of some of the things that were done during the bailout period is instances of that. But consistent with the other commitments I have, I wouldn't see constitutional limitations at work there. Rather, I think the political mechanism seems to be the path that we've chosen in America, and it works reasonably well to hold people to account. But the political mechanism only works if there's some level of transparency, that we can link effects to what Congress does. To the extent that judges are complicit, by allowing Congress to enact laws that do not expressly say, and you can sue for this with a class action and all these other things that make American civil litigation unique, Congress is allowed to slip the bounds of political accountability. And one of the things courts can do is go back to Congress and say, we're not going to put into the statutes things that you haven't said, of which I think the private cause of action jurisprudence, the anti-private cause of action jurisprudence, is a wonderful example. It's a way of promoting transparency. If you want to do it, Congress, okay, but you got to do it. And once you do it, of course, you have to defend it to the voters. But since we don't have to defend what we do to the voters, we judges, don't use us to avoid that level of accountability.
All right. Thank you. Questions from all of you? I think we just have one microphone on this side of the room now, so you may have to either go around the back or come around the front. All right, go ahead.
I'm Sammy Early from Santa Clara University. Professor Zwicky, I admit I generally find your arguments pretty compelling, but when it comes to the Dodd-Frank Act, I'm a little confused with how you square your arguments, you know, against generally rent-seeking behaviors, which we dislike because they increase transactional costs in the economy, with your opposition to the regulation of the interchange fees, which are essentially a rent-seeking behavior on the part of large financial institutions that hit small businesses particularly hard. How do you square those two together?
That's, I think, a completely inaccurate understanding of how interchange fees have emerged. Nobody's made a compelling argument that that allowing interchange fees to be set by markets that there's anything wrong with that. It seems to be quite efficient. It's the logic that comes out of a two-sided market. So you may as well, I mean, if you want to make that argument, then you should have to argue that Congress needs to intervene and basically cap, you know, newspapers are also two-sided markets, right? Advertisers pay a premium to subsidize subscribers so that they can get their ads to them. That's the same thing with interchange. Merchants bear the cost of interchange, and consumers get their debit cards for free, basically. The result of capping interchange fees that merchants want to do is that they're going to transfer that cost onto consumers who are not very well organized. What we're seeing already is that consumers are going to start having to pay more bank fees. You're going to start to have to pay more for a debit card. You're going to have to pay monthly fees. And a lot of other fees are going to be imposed on consumers. That's bad, number one. What's bad, especially bad, is what that means is a lot of people are going to be driven out of the mainstream financial system because they're going to be unwilling or unable to pay $9 or $12 or $15 a month just so that they can have a credit card or debit card. Now, those people at least have free checking. After the Durbin Amendment comes in, those people aren't going to be able to do that. And what you're basically doing is creating, you know, it's a boom opportunity for check cashers. Those who issue these, you know, sort of crummy prepaid cards that aren't issued by financial institutions. But the unintended consequences are going to just be huge. And so what they did was they just intervened on a purely political basis. They held no hearings to do this. They had no justification for why they chose this particular intervention over something more mild. And there's going to just be a huge amount of unintended consequences. That's very bad economics. It's great politics, though, right? Why is that? Because, well, number one, they got millions of dollars from the merchants. Number two, they only put in limits on debit cards. They did not limit credit cards, which means what? Now, everybody who has a debit card, which is going to become more expensive, and a credit card, which is going to stay the same, everybody's going to switch from debit to credit. Now, why is that ironic? Because credit cards have interchange fees that are 50% higher than debit cards. So, Senator Durbin's pretty savvy, right? Which is, you know, as soon as the rule goes into effect, if people start ramping up use of their credit cards, here will come the merchants again for another round of lobbying, right? For price caps on credit cards, and that's what we saw in Australia when they limited put price caps on interchange fees. This always creates a regulatory dialectic where you intervene, you create unintended consequences, and then people come back and they lobby you again to solve the unintended consequences, thereby creating a whole new round of unintended consequences. And that's just the regulatory dialectic of interventionism that I think Ludwig von Mises described pretty well in his book, Interventionism, and still seems quite accurate to me today. So I just don't buy the premise, I guess.
All right, next question.
Hi, Michael Peters, Brooklyn Law School. My question is for Dean Mahoney. I like the distinction that you drew between restrained government and economic freedom, and it reminded me of an old saying that Milton Friedman used to say, which was that economic freedom is a necessary condition for political freedom, but it's not a sufficient condition. And I wanted to know if you would agree with that statement, and second, whether you think that would indicate that economic freedom would tend to lead towards political freedom, but the reverse would not necessarily be true.
It's an interesting question, and I think a lot of it really depends, unfortunately, on exactly what your definitions of economic freedom and political freedom are, especially the definition of political freedom. It is certainly true that there are plenty of places that have, in principle, competitive elections, just to take one instance of political freedom, but we have some doubts about the actual freedom, so Russia being kind of the poster child for that. So I think at least economic freedom, we can look at something that's sort of intermediate in between formal rules and wealth and say this is economic freedom. So generally low inflation, generally a low regulatory environment, etc. Probably the easiest intermediate result that I can think of in political freedom is how often does a government leave voluntarily? That seems to me, in some sense, to be the real, the best definition of political freedoms. How often can the voters say, we don't like this government, and the government says, oh, okay, so we're going and your people can come in? I think it is probably right that it's hard to have that without some degree of economic freedom, because without some degree of economic freedom, you don't have the level of wealth that allows the people who are not in power to say, I'm not going to put up with that result.
All right. Thank you. Next question.
Hi. My question deals with the administrative state and regulatory aspects. If discretion in times of economic uncertainty is going to compel Congress to outsource a lot of regulating and rulemaking responsibilities to administrative agencies and similar boards, and you have the Chevron deference standard staring you right in the face if it ever goes into the judicial branch, I mean, to what extent does that impact the ability for courts to meaningfully protect pro-growth policies and economic freedom? And to the extent the Chevron deference standard does impact that, is it worth revisiting?
I won't speak to Chevron deference, maybe one of these guys do, but it prompts the observation that one of the things that is striking about the financial crisis is how pathetic Congress was, and their willingness to basically allow Bush Paulson to accumulate power. Now, number one, I think that a lot of us in the room probably bear some responsibility for that. That there was, conservative thinkers who were basically pushing the theory of the imperial executive in times of the War of Terror. And what Bush and Paulson did wasn't that much different from what a lot of people were excusing them for during the time of the War on Terror, which is something I think that's probably worth further reflection for those of us who are in the Federalist Society. But the second thing as we see is, if you think about the GM and Chrysler bailout, it especially proves the point, which is what happened there was that there was a proposal to bail out GM and Chrysler. Now, why was there a proposal to bail out GM and Chrysler? Because everybody in Congress knew that TARP money could only be used for financial institutions, not for car makers, right? They knew that's what they had voted for. So a proposal came about to allow bailout money for GM and Chrysler. The House voted for it. The Senate voted it down. President Bush, the Bush-Paulson response was, it's too bad these idiots in Congress don't realize we need to bail out the car makers, so we're going to just give them TARP money. Right? And the response to that from Congress was a sternly worded letter a few days later from a few senators. Now, I'm sorry, that's just pathetic that Congress basically was willing to do that, right? Which is Congress's view was, we want to have an auto bailout, but we don't want to be seen as voting for it. So wouldn't it be great if the president would do this? And that's basically what they did, is that the president did it and Congress just rolled over. At least Congress showed a little bit of backbone when Hank Paulson showed up with his 3-page ransom note and said, give me $1 trillion or whatever so I can, give it to my friends at Goldman Sachs. At least they pushed back a little bit back then, but then they finally did it anyway, right? So I think that what we do see see is an abdication of congressional responsibility in which the executive and the courts have basically stepped in saying somebody needs to be a grown-up here, which then I think reinforces the cycle where it allows Congress to abdicate even more the next time around and leads to this, you know, again, this dialectic expansion of unelected judges and administrative agencies, such that, you know, by that time Chevron to some extent is, you know, everything in the bailout happened. You know, GM and Chrysler never even got reviewed by the Supreme Court. Most of these things never got challenged. Even though, for instance, I think it's clear, Gary Lawson spoke at this conference last year, and I think he's quite compelling, that the use of TARP money for GM and Chrysler was blatantly illegal. It just can't, there's just no way you can get there from here. That was never even heard by a court, so we never even got to the Chevron issue.
Next question.
Hi, Tom Cotavilla from Colorado. You seem to suggest, Professor Zwicky, that there's this chain of bailouts, and I agree with you in that it seems that when a government loses its ability to bail out the financial sector, it's usually not far behind and falling. It suggests an implicit government guarantee over pretty much all financial institutions, just a question of size. A couple of questions result then. First one, how do you think people would react if they actually made this implicit guarantee explicit? And second, if there is a way to change that, how would the courts play into that solution, whatever it might be?
Interesting question. One of the things that you see is there's these various indexes of economic freedom, for instance. Heritage and the Wall Street Journal publishes one. And one of the measures, Dean Mahoney's been talking about some, but one of the measures of economic freedom is the independence of the banking system from the government. Because what you see, sort of the essence of crony capitalism is this cozy relationship between banks and the government, where basically politicians then use their power and their influence to basically get banks to make loans to favored businesses, to favored individuals, to themselves, that sort of thing. And so you get that sort of routine corruption. I think we've seen that already as part of the financial response to the financial crisis, which is, you know, one of the things that's striking about General Motors is that one of the things that happened in Chrysler, why they had to plunder the secured creditors they did, was because most of the secured creditors rolled over. Why? Because most of the secured creditors in Chrysler were most of the secured creditors held by banks that had received TARP money. And you didn't hear a squeak out of them, even though they were only getting 29 cents on the dollar. And then basically President Obama used the fact that the TARP banks had rolled over as a club to try to browbeat everybody else into submission. I think that's the dynamic you get when you start getting entanglement between the financial sector, because it's so fungible and so, you know, sort of these relations between the financial sector and the government. I would think that an explicit government guarantee could only make it worse, I would think, but create a whole host of a whole host of other problems. I think that, you know, I'm not sure that's a satisfactory, or if that's exactly what you were asking about. But you know, you've got the problem is that we saw Fannie and Freddie. The reason Fannie and Freddie were Fannie and Freddie because everybody knew they had an implicit government guarantee, even though they were private. You know, there was basically no risk premium attached to holding bonds for Fannie and Freddie, and the people who bought it with zero risk premium were rewarded in the end. I think that that if you're going to go explicit, then you're going to have to go for sort of complete government control of the financial sector is what it seems like to me, and it seems to me we want to be moving in the opposite direction.
Well, I was just going to make one very quick observation, which is whatever one thinks about bailouts, it's pretty hard to guarantee their opposite. That is to say, it's hard to put in place a system where everyone says, I know that if Citibank gets in huge trouble, it is not going to be bailed out, because what you see is exactly what we saw in late 2008, which is the investment and commercial banks come to Congress and say, if you don't give us our money, we're going to shoot this economy. And Congress doesn't have the nerve to say, you know, go ahead, make my day.
All right, last question.
Sarah Childress, VA Law. I'd like to return to the discussion earlier about the distinction between civil and common law and the independence of the judiciary. I'm wondering how the debate between adversarial and inquisitorial fact-finding fits into this, and whether or not that might be correlated with entrenchment of class structures or mobility of citizens, especially the middle class.
Dean Mahoney, I think that's for you.
Wow, that's that is a big question. There's actually been some debate about that, although entirely at a kind of amateur historian level rather than an empirical level. So one way you could look at it is that the common law developed an adversarial system basically because you had very powerful barons in France who feared one another more than they feared the king. And so they wanted to keep a kind of central system of resolving disputes that wouldn't allow their neighboring barons to get the better of them, and it's sort of the opposite in England. There's one set of kind of economic historians who've made that argument, that it really comes down to whether the system was going to allow local folks to play a big role in resolving disputes or not play a big role in resolving disputes. In England, you let the locals play a role. In France, you didn't let the locals play a role. Now, I'm not terribly persuaded by that argument, because in fact it came packaged with, in England at least, under Henry II, a much more vigorous assertion of central government control over litigation generally. So it doesn't seem to me to really hold a lot as a historical matter. One alternative would just be to observe that in England, you've got a geographically compact place. You've got, given that it's small and geographically compact, you've got enough literate people to resolve disputes around the country. It's obviously not a high degree of literacy, but you don't have a large geographical area that you need to cover, so you can kind of send them around and they can resolve disputes. In France, there's sort of no hope. I mean, you had to kind of try to centralize the dispute resolution because you didn't have enough literate people, and it's actually really starts to become difficult to resolve disputes over things like land titles or contracts if you can't read. Do I have a good answer to your question? No, I don't have a good answer to your question, because just there's a lot going on in the history that I think makes it very difficult to say, here is the reason why England developed an adversarial system and the continent developed a more centralized inquisitorial system.
If I could just throw out a quick footnote to that. I mean, one of the attractions of an adversarial system is that the advocates, who are a necessary part of the adversarial system, form a class from which judges can be drawn, as opposed to the administrative ministerial approach that you see in the civil law. But I agree completely with Dean Mahoney that we can't tell what is cause and what is effect here.
All right, let's thank the panel for a very interesting discussion.